Okay, well, good evening, and welcome to another in our medical ethics series under the general rubric of the Nussbaum Family Medical Halacha and Ethics Institute. Thank you to the Nussbaum family for dedicating these programs. And this one actually owes special credit to the Nussbaum family in that Dr. Nussbaum really wanted to see a dental program this year. So we have succeeded in putting in a dental program, and indeed we have, separate from the CME credit, it qualifies for Category 3 credits for dentists. Unfortunately, not to Category 1 or 2, because I'm not giving advice on how to actually practice dentistry, but on the whole, I think that's a good thing. In terms of the credit, and I'll probably have to repeat this at some point, because I see people are still making their way in. But the way I'd like to work this is for people to sign in via the chat, if whether you want to join the email list or whether you need credit. Now, if your name is already showing on your screen, there's no need for you to sign in, meaning I'm writing everything down as people come in, and if your name is showing, then you don't need to do that. Unless you're not on my email list, in which case having your name isn't going to help me to send you your credit form. So if you're not on the email list, then yes, then we'll need the for you to sign in. But if you either have your name showing and I have your email address, or send me a message via the chat, then I'll be able to acknowledge that you were here for credit purposes, and we'll send you that that certificate. Okay. Two other notes. As usual, I send out a survey afterwards to the list. That's very important in terms of our ongoing accreditation for these programs. So I'll ask that people please fill out the survey. Even if you are not a medical professional, you should receive the survey anyway, and please fill out the parts that are relevant for you. Obviously, the parts that are, about how it changed your practice or whatever are, less relevant. Also, I'm going to begin by when I begin, I'm going to mute everybody. You can still unmute yourself. It's just that the default will be to be muted just because of background noise and the like. But as usual, if you have a question, a comment, feel free to unmute yourself and bring up the question. It's actually better, I find, for my purposes, it's better if people unmute themselves and ask a question, as opposed to writing a question in the chat. Because generally speaking, if you write a question in the chat, then I get distracted. I'm actually happier if people just ask a question. And we'll see how that goes. If it becomes unruly, it'll be a different story. But otherwise, that's the way I prefer to do things. Okay? Are we we're good to go? Okay. So the topic for this evening, dental emergencies on Shabbos. And for the most part, this is not a COVID-19 topic, which I am relieved to say, because honestly, there's been a lot of that. There will be one source that does relate to it. This is not intended as psak. I am not giving any rulings for any cases. I believe, as we've discussed on multiple occasions, simply discussing issues, but the halachic rulings should be given on a case-by-case basis by your rabbi. Also, because there's a lot to fit into our time frame, we have 90 minutes, but that's not as many minutes as it sounds. So, there's a lot of summarizing that necessarily needs to be done. I gave you a link at the top of the page called Dentistry in Tanakh and Talmud. It's a link to a class that I gave years ago, and it's a little bit lighter than this one. The one that we're going to be dealing with is very technical. For those whose bent is more philosophical, you can look on the source sheet for that. I'm looking at the names here, and I think everyone here so far is on the email list. There are one or two names I don't know. But overall, it looks like people are on it. If anyone doesn't have the source sheet, if you could do me a favor and just let me know, I'll post it in the chat. I'll also send it out with the follow-up email as well. Okay, so a couple of notes that we have to begin with in terms of this, you know, very technical type of a shear. It's important to recognize that even though this is technical, the fundamental issue involved in dental care on Shabbos is an ethical one. Meaning, the Torah places Shabbos and Yom Tov on a pedestal. These are days that represent basic Jewish belief. They represent our core relationship with God. They're inviolate. At the same time, the Torah demands that we value health, our own health, and the health of people who are around us. So that presents a basic ethical halachic problem. How do we balance Shabbos and Yom Tov with the health of others? Right? On the one hand, we have to safeguard Shabbos and Yom Tov. On the other hand, we have to safeguard health. What do you do when they come into conflict? So this is basically an ethical issue, but it plays out in terms of technicalities. That's just one thought that I wanted to introduce at the beginning. Second, I titled this Dental Emergencies on Shabbat. So what kinds of needs are actually emergencies? So here's the COVID-19 reference. If you take a look on your sheet, at the very beginning, from the Ontario Dental Association, COVID-19 updates from the ODA. What is considered emergency treatment? A true emergency includes trauma, injury to the mouth and face, severe infection, such as an abscess or a swelling, bleeding that continues for a long time, dental pain that can't be managed by over-the-counter medications, such as Tylenol or Advil. So we're going to deal with some of those, as well as look at some other time-sensitive needs that may not qualify as true emergencies. However, they're time-sensitive, and in that sense, they become emergencies. The definition of emergency, I think, from the ODA, includes also the level of harm, not just the time factor. We'll have to look at some cases where there are time factors that are involved, even if they're not as dire in terms of their needs. Last beginning note before we get to the vignettes. Someone emailed me in advance of the session asking me, why do you have to bother a Jewish observant dentist on Shabbos? Why don't you just go to an emergency clinic? The truth of the matter is that for many of the issues that we're dealing with, it is better to ask someone who isn't Jewish to take care of it on Shabbos. That's absolutely true. However, sometimes the Jewish dentist is the one who is available. And sometimes the Jewish dentist needs to know what to do personally, especially as that dentist has an obligation to help other people. Someone comes to your door, the answer of, sorry, I'm Jewish, go find somebody else, may not be the most sensitive way to handle the situation. So I think it's important for the Jewish dentist to know what exactly she or he is able to do. So with all of that in mind, I turn to the vignettes that you see on your sheet. All of the dentists in this case are Dr. Schwartz. So, Robbie, this isn't you, but unless you've acquired a degree in dentistry. But this is Dr. Schwartz's practice. Abraham, age 7, is brought to Dr. Schwartz in shul on Shabbat morning complaining of a toothache. Naked eye observation and probing indicate a significant dental caries. What may Dr. Schwartz do for Avraham? So let's pause there and ask the question. What may Dr. Schwartz do on behalf of 7-year-old Avraham? What would you think? Dentists especially, who know what should be done in such a situation if it were not Shabbos but Tuesday. Tell him to take Tylenol. Okay. Tell Avram to take Tylenol. Maybe the answer. Other suggestions?
Refer him to a non-Jewish dentist
who will do what? What will the non-Jewish dentist do in this circumstance that Tylenol doesn't do? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Well, let's see. We'll figure it out. But that's our first question. Second question. Sarah, age 7, is brought to Dr. Schwartz on Shabbos morning, complaining of pain from a very loose baby tooth. She skipped dinner Friday night. She intends to skip breakfast and lunch as well. The tooth seems ready for pulling. Bleeding is likely to be minimal. What may Dr. Schwartz do for Sarah? What may Dr. Schwartz do on behalf of Sarah? Well, again, let's pretend it's not Shabbos. It's now Monday. What would happen if it were Monday? Pull the tooth. Yeah, pull the tooth. Okay, could you pull this tooth on Shabbos? I see a head shake no from a non-dentist.
I asked this question before of you, and you said yes.
Okay. So...
She doesn't seem to be in any particular pain, and the fact that she could abstain from things would indicate that it's not all that serious.
Well, she's complaining of pain. She is complaining of pain. Okay, that's our second case. And indeed, we did discuss this case quite a few years ago, so you have a good memory. Third question. Simi, age 13, trips and falls on Shabbos afternoon, knocking out a permanent tooth. Within 5 minutes, he is at Dr. Schwartz's door, holding the tooth and asking what to do. What may Dr. Schwartz tell him to do?
To reinsert it as quickly as possible, because time is an important factor in reimplantation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Time is a very important factor here, or so I hear from all the dentists, including now Dr. Nussbaum here. So inserting the tooth back into the spot, will that be sufficient?
You also have to stabilize it.
And how do you stabilize it?
Either by acrylic or by wires, any one of a number of ways.
Okay. So we're going to have to talk about those different ways. And then the last case, I'm not 100% sure we're going to get to it within our time, but I included it in case we can. This one, I taught the class on dental emergencies on Shabbos. It's got to be, I don't know, 2012 or 2013. And I had this case in mind when I did that class, but I didn't get to it then. Maybe we'll get to it now. Rachel, age 22, recently married, is eating dinner with her new husband on the first night of a 3-day Yom Tov. During dinner, she loses a porcelain crown from one of her teeth. The crown is aesthetic rather than protective. What may Dr. Schwartz do for her?
Well, first of all, you weren't clear whether the crown was displaced or whether it was actually swallowed. Or lost.
Okay. Let's say that the crown is just displaced.
If it's displaced, then presumably, are we talking about Shabbos or Yom Tov?
So, let's say it's Yom Tov. I'm going to talk about the difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov later on, but I'll spoil it now and say there's no practical difference for an issue like this. So that's a creative solution. We may come back to this as a possibility, the idea of having two people do it at the same time. Okay. Let's get into the basic principles that govern what Jewish law is going to recommend. And I'm going to show you here, if you haven't looked at the sheets in advance, but you just downloaded it or printed it, if you jump to number 24... Jump to source number 24. After that source, I gave you a table. And that table is of hierarchy of, first, levels of illness or pain. That's in the first category. Second category gives you sample cases illustrating the category. And then the third column gives you what sort of treatment would be acceptable for somebody who is in that particular category of pain, discomfort, illness. So as we go through this, you may want to keep your eye on that table. It may be useful. All right. As we said before, we place a great emphasis on saving lives, including violating Shabbat in order to do so. But the degree to which we are allowed to break the laws of Shabbat depends on two variables. Variable number one, the level of need. And number two, the level of violation of Shabbat involved in whatever the medical act is. So level of need could be danger, meaning, you know, life and death danger, could be disfigurement, and it could be pain. There are all sorts of different levels that are possible. That's number one. Number two, level of violation. What type of violation of the rules of Shabbat would be involved in this particular medical act? Is it violating biblical law or rabbinic law? Is it a matter of a Jew doing it? Is it a matter of asking a non-Jew to be the one to do it? Those distinctions matter. Is one doing the act in the routine way of doing it or in an unusual way? Those are all considerations under the general heading of, so what exactly is the violation? There's also a separate concern besides these two variables. Right? Again, variable number one is what's the level of need? Variable number two is what's the level of violation of the laws of Shabbat or of Yom Tov? But then there's this third issue, separate concern, which is the act of making medicine historically required a violation of biblical laws of Shabbat. Because in order to make medicine, historically, you ground up ingredients. Grinding up anything on Shabbat, you know, the things that grow from the ground at any rate, is a violation of biblical law. So that the rabbis created a unique prohibition against using medicine on Shabbat for a low-level illness, or it's a mild illness, out of concern that you might come to grind ingredients in order to make medicine. In other words, they are not dealing in today's society, but dealing in society of centuries past, or even, you know, a century ago, theoretically. If I woke up on a Tuesday morning and my tooth was bothering me, and I knew, so what you do is you grind up this herb and you apply it to the spot and now you'll feel better. So that's what I would do on a Tuesday morning. If I wake up on Shabbat and I want to apply something to my tooth and I realize I don't have anything, I'm going to grind stuff up, and that's a violation of Shabbat that is not justified for a low level of illness. So therefore they said, don't take medicines on Shabbat if you're dealing with mild illness, lest you grind up ingredients. Now, the ideas behind this, the relevance of it today, what happens when you live in a society in which, as a general principle, people don't make their own Tylenol, these are all very good questions. How does this all interface with homeopathic medicine, in which people might actually grind something up? These are all interesting questions. It's not for our topic right now. The only reason I raise it is because we have to understand that that's also an issue here. If you're just dealing with minor aches and pains, then the answer is going to be then don't take medicine. Okay, so let's categorize things like I did in the table that's after number 24. Let's take the first category. This is called in Hebrew chole sheyesh bo sakana, somebody who is dangerously ill. We're talking either their life is known to be in danger or their life could be in danger. So this includes an infection which could cause a threat to life in the event that we were to wait. If you take a look at source number one on your sheet, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, also known as the Mishnah Berurah, gives you a case that is a life and death case as far as Jewish law is concerned. meaning, he's commenting on a previous text, and he says what the text means is that they know clearly that the illness will not get worse by waiting until night after Shabbat. He says you wait if you know clearly that the illness will not get worse. But if I don't know clearly that the illness will not get worse, then I treat it right now. That's the idea. When you're dealing with an infection, very often you have no idea until you start actually examining and digging in. That's when you can determine it. So therefore, as Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan wrote in his Mishnah Brura, 120 years ago, he said, if you don't know clearly, you treat it now on Shabbos. In source number two, I brought you a practical application of it. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham, in his Nishmas Avram, I've quoted him many, many times. He was the head of internal medicine at the Shari Tzedek Hospital. He writes, and in all of this, I'm just sticking with my English translation that I put on the sheets, but you have the original Hebrew as well. We delay surgery and any other treatment for a dangerously ill patient until after Shabbat, where there is no concern that his situation could worsen and he could enter danger. If I know that he'll be okay by waiting, then fine, then I can wait until after Shabbos. But if leaving it untreated could cause a life and death case on Shabbos, then the patient is considered to be in danger right now. That's the rule. So if you take a look at source number three, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham quotes Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman told me that in any case of quick spreading dangerous illness, such that we will be frightened during the week, one must treat and operate on Shabbat if that can be done immediately. Even if on a weekday this treatment or surgery might actually wait a day or two due to more urgent surgeries. In other words, you might look at it and say, the reality of hospital operating rooms is that which gets called an emergency is treated immediately unless something else that's called an even higher emergency comes in and needs care. Even if they say this is urgent and this is immediate, the reality is that there are things that are more urgent and more immediate. So don't say, he says, just because this can get pushed off by something else doesn't mean that you don't do it on Shabbos. You still do this on Shabbos, writes Rabbi Dr. Abraham, quoting Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so long as it's something that we would normally be frightened by and want to treat that day. Is this clear? Yes? I see some heads nodding, but I see other heads not moving. It's hard because when you're in a room with people, it's a lot easier to get a sense of how people are getting it. So if you could, people could be more effusive when they either get it or don't get it. That would be really helpful. I've been, doing these Zoom classes now for weeks and weeks, but certain aspects of it continue to be frustrating. So that's the basic principle. That which is dangerous and could even be, it is considered possibly dangerous. It also includes a very interesting category. It's called makah shel chalal. Makah shel chalal. What does the word chalal mean in modern Hebrew? Anybody know? Sorry? Outer space. Correct. In modern Hebrew, we use the term chalal to refer to outer space. Classically, one of the meanings of the word chalal is hollow, a hollow area. And as it's used in a medical context here, what it refers to is the inside of the body. Makah shel chalal means an internal injury. And the Talmud tells us that an internal wound is considered automatically to be dangerous. Take a look, please, at source number four. Ravina went to Rav Ashi's house. This is Ravina and Rav Ashi, you're talking about 5th century Common Era. So Ravina went to Rav Ashi's house and saw that a donkey had trampled his foot. He was soaking it in vinegar. Ravina said, this is on Shabbat. So Ravina said, doesn't the master agree with Rav Hillel? One may not use vinegar on Shabbat. You can't soak yourself in vinegar on Shabbat. That's considered a use of medicine that we've said before is inappropriate. To which he replied, the back of the hand and the top of the foot are different. Why? Because Rav Adi Bar Matna said, quoting Rav, the back of the hand and top of the foot are like an internal wound. One violates Shabbat for them. So in other words, he says, internal wounds are automatically considered dangerous, as well as wounds on the back of the hand, the top of the foot. I'm not really discussing the back of the hand, top of the foot point, although that's an interesting one. My focus is on this makash shel chalal, this wound that is internal. Hang on one second, I'm getting a message that my speaker is not working well. I know how to solve this problem. Give me one moment. Okay. Yeah, this happens from time to time, unfortunately, for reasons that I don't quite get. But it's the way it goes. Computer science major has no idea why this happens. In any case, the idea here is that indeed a makash al halal, an internal wound, is considered dangerous by default. So take a look at source number 5, where you see it in the Mishnah Berurah, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. He writes in his work, for those who may not be that familiar with Rabbi Kagan's work, the Mishnah Berurah is considered a very authoritative work of Jewish law, written in the beginning of, the very beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th. As a commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. So he says, an internal wound, or any dangerous illness like a burning fever of the entire body, these things are presumed to be life and death dangers. So here's a question for you. I keep using the term internal wound. What exactly constitutes an internal wound? What does that mean?
Anything
Anything from the mouth on, including the teeth. Is that your intuition, or is that based on a text?
Text.
Ah, okay. I have a note from somebody in the chat who came in after I asked not to put things in the chat, but he sent it privately to me, so it's okay. The internal infection or bleeding. So there's actually a lot of debate regarding how to view the definition of internal. Someone else was going to suggest? No? Okay. So take a look at source number 6, please. This is from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. I brought you the two authors. One is Rabbi Yosef Karo, the primary author of the Shulchan Aruch, and the other Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who wrote commentary to the Shulchan Aruch in Poland. So both of them writing in the middle of the 16th century. So Rabbi Karo, also known as the Mechaber, the author, the compiler, wrote, one violates Shabbat for any internal wound, meaning from the teeth and inward, including the teeth. This is specifically where one of the internal organs has a wound or infection or the like. Aches do not qualify. So he says, internal means from the teeth and inward, including the teeth. Along comes Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, and he says, side note, one whose teeth hurt, who has pain such that he wishes to remove a tooth, may tell a non-Jew to do it. We're going to come back to pulling teeth a little bit later. That part is not necessarily so relevant for us right now. But the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says it begins at the teeth. And if you take a look at number 8, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, again in his Mishnah Berurah, says certainly where the seat of the teeth, meaning the chanichim, is ill. This is included in internal wounds. Chanichim are unclear. It may be a reference to the gums. It may be a reference to the palate. It sounds a lot more like the gums, certainly. But we count teeth as an internal wound, and therefore it is considered to be automatically dangerous. And Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, in his Refuah Kahalacha, rules the same way as well. However, there are two important limiting factors here. Limiting factor number one is that we're not talking about where someone has general pain. There has to be some kind of a wound involved specifically. And I say that based on source number 9, I say that based on source number 6, where they mention specifically a wound and aches don't qualify. So there has to be some kind of a wound, an injury, a sore, something like that. Number 2, if I know that this is actually not dangerous, then I can't violate Shabbat for it. In other words, you can't say, well, all teeth issues are considered internal wounds, and therefore you violate Shabbat for any of them, and therefore there's no need for a conversation anymore. And in fact, we can end this pretty quickly. Doesn't work that way. I say this based on source number 9. I had skipped number 7. Number 7 is one of the sources that indicates that wounds of the teeth are considered to be dangerous. But it identifies, in particular, an illness called Safidna. But I'm jumping to source number 9, which refers to that Safidna, this illness of the teeth. He says, with Safidna, even should the patient and doctor say there was no need to desecrate, meaning no need to violate Shabbat, we would say they're not expert. Our sages have a tradition, this is dangerous. For other pains of the teeth, which we consider internal wounds, we assume that we should desecrate, but should the doctor or patient say there is no need, we would not desecrate. So just to make sure that was clear, because he goes in two different directions. First, Rabbi Kagan, the Mishnah Berurah, says that that there is a type of illness called Safidna, which involves the teeth. And says, I don't care what a doctor says to you, I don't care what the patient says to you, this is considered to be dangerous by tradition, and therefore you would treat this right away on Shabbat. Do whatever you need to do. However, for other pains of the teeth, he says, the default assumption is to desecrate Shabbat, but if the doctor or patient say there's no need, we would not desecrate. Now, I should make note of one thing here. When he says that when he makes the comment here that if the patient says there's no need, don't worry about it, this reflects an earlier time in terms of the level of medical sophistication that a patient was presumed to have. We have a principle, lev yodea marat nafsho, that the heart knows its own bitterness, and that informs a view that says that the patient is eligible to weigh in medically. Today, I don't think we look at the patient's knowledge that way, even though patient's knowledge is now augmented by Dr. Google, and therefore patients know everything. Nonetheless, the fact that the patient says this doesn't need treatment doesn't matter if the trained physician says this does need treatment. If the dentist says this better be taken care of now, the fact that the patient says, I'll wait till after Shabbos, is irrelevant. The expert is the one to weigh in, and that's a very important principle. So we've included within this category of chole sheyesh bo sakana, the patient who is dangerously ill, a situation in which there is immediate danger, where there is an infection that could cause a threat to life if we waited, where there is internal injury which includes the teeth, unless it is known to be safe. And then I bring you one other note. This is from a sefer called the Nishma Shabbos, and he's quoting the Melachim Omnayich, who is Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, son-in-law of Rav Yashiv. And the position that he takes is an interesting one. He's willing to argue that unbearable pain qualifies as well for this category of life and death. Take a look at source number 10. And I have seen in Malachim Omnayich that when the pain is especially strong and unbearable, it is close to life-threatening, as one might lose his mind when struck by strong pain. And he says he brought a similar idea earlier from Imre Yosher. But in my humble opinion, this is not found at all. He says it doesn't actually exist. Unless it's known that someone has a weak nervous system, one should not permit biblical violations for this. He doesn't think that you actually have practical cases like it. I wonder about this. The whether you could, the one that, which I think I mentioned when we discussed this 8 years ago, I think I may have mentioned it then as well, is trigeminal neuralgia, which everything I've heard about in terms of the pain that's involved says that that's an extremely high level of pain. Ernie, is that did I mention it then? I did not? Okay. But that may be in this category. It's a possibility that you could make that argument. So these are the first level of illness. What is one allowed to do on Shabbat for somebody in this category? So we have a general principle. To save a life on Shabbat, people are familiar with, we override Shabbat. However, the principle is that it is dechuya and not hutra. And what that means is that we don't say, so do everything, you know, and don't worry about what the level of prohibition is. We do whatever is necessary. But if I have two options at my disposal, and they're equally good, and they're equally accessible, then I should take the option that will involve less of a violation of Shabbat, rather than take the one that has the higher violation of Shabbat. If assuming that all other things are equal, if they're not equal, if taking the lesser violation of Shabbat means I have to go find someone who can do it, or it's not as likely to take care of the patient, then I don't do that. It's only where both options are the same that will follow this rule. So what am I allowed to do? Again, direct treatment by a Jew in violation of biblical law. That's what would be letter of the law permitted. If you take a look at source number 11, you'll see the Mishnah Brura, who tells you what you do is whatever would be done during the week. He says, where it is clear that withholding treatment is not dangerous, then even though one needs it and it is normally done, one doesn't do it on Shabbat other than via a non-Jew. It's like the treatment of a patient who is not dangerously ill. He says, if it's clear that withholding the treatment isn't needed, then even though one needs it, it is normally done, then don't do it yourself on Shabbat. But the implication is, in the event that withholding that treatment is dangerous, if this is what's normally done, then it's what you would do on Shabbat as well. You treat it the same way you would during the week, and that was really implied by what we saw from Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham earlier. Also, all supporting steps that are needed in order to strengthen the patient's health are also done. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, in source number 12, notes this. He's talking about supporting steps. And he says, even though there's no danger in withholding the supporting step, because there is danger in his disease, and there is some need for the treatment, it will be done on a weekday, so we do it on Shabbat. So to give you a practical example of this, let's say you're talking about a patient who is indeed, you know what? Flip to number 13. I don't need to give you an example. I have an example on there. I'm not sure why I didn't just lead with that one. But this is a perfect example. From Shmirat Shabbat Kilchata, Rabbi Yeshua Neuvert, the student of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, he said, a patient who is dangerously ill may use medicine, even if it's not needed to save him from danger, such as a pill for a toothache. So in other words, you have somebody who's in the hospital because of a life and death condition, and by the way, he also has a toothache. So he says, you give him the medicine for the toothache. Even though that's not what's saving the patient's life, nonetheless, the patient being in a life and death case means that you also take care of the secondary needs that are involved. So that's our statement of the patient who is in danger, whose life is in danger, and what we say in terms of treating that patient. Interesting application of this. Case comes up. Patient has a tooth that shows signs of deep and immediate infection, such that treatment should begin immediately. So Dr. Ellie Wolfson told me when I looked into this years ago, that what you do in such a case is drill into the gum, remove the infected pulp and drain any infected fluid, or B, pull the tooth and initiate antibiotics. Does that match with what people say? That conversation I had with them was 8 years ago, so I don't know if things have changed in the last 8 years in terms of this aspect of dentistry.
Why would he perforate the gum?
He saw it drilling into the gum. I think it's for the sake of drainage.
And why wouldn't he drain it through the tooth itself?
A pulpotomy or a
pulpectomy.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think a misstep should be drilling into the tooth.
You can put it in a drain when you have an abscess there and a swelling. Otherwise, you would be putting it in a drain.
No, that is what I understood. Gina, you had your hand raised? You're on mute.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is my first Zoom class. Usually it's my kids doing these. Sorry.
No problem.
If there was an option to treat with antibiotics, would that be the preference?
So if I have an option, and that's a reasonable treatment during the week also, then it certainly would seem to be better. That would certainly seem to be a better option. You know, going with what I said before about it being dechuya, that really this is not, it's not a free-for-all on Shabbos. We should be trying to reduce whatever violation is involved. If you can, you know, if that's a standard treatment, then sure. Right. I mean, part of the problem with this, and that's what I meant in the beginning when I said I'm not giving rulings for particular cases, is that this is very subjective. It's very case-dependent. It depends on what presents in front of you.
I came in late, so I didn't hear what you were saying at the beginning.
Yeah.
But it has happened numerous times where people in shul come up to me with, you know, pain or whatever they're feeling and what they're, you know, I guess I don't know when it's okay to write a prescription or not. It's a few hours difference. Is it going to make a difference really until Shabbos is over or not? I don't know. But if the patient feels that they're pain enough, they're coming to our Shabbat, I usually feel I should write a prescription.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot, right.
I've never had to do that.
I mean, it really goes back to what we had said before about the question of the whether this is something which you would leave, you know, on a day during the week. Would you say to them, you know, we have to treat this now, or would you say, you know what? I'm at work right now. It's going to be a big pain for me to come in and be seen. Do you think I can get away with waiting 8 hours and then I'll be able to come in? If you would tell them on a Tuesday, sure, you can wait 8 hours, then on Shabbos also they should wait 8 hours. That's, I think, the way that we would look at it. Dr. Nussbaum, you had your hand up.
Giving antibiotics, it's not that if the patient is in pain, antibiotics will not do anything. It takes hours for the antibiotics to work. The important thing to do in these cases is to establish some sort of drainage through the tooth.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that is an important point, but the drainage is serving what purpose at this stage?
Probably to relieve pressure.
To relieve pressure. But that's a matter of relieving the discomfort. That's not a matter of curing the problem, correct?
Well, eventually, no. What you're trying to do right now, the patient is in pain, as I understand.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, antibiotics will not cure the pain.
Right.
Maybe the best thing to do is to give him an injection in order to freeze the area so that at least he gets some relief from the pain.
Right, so I'm not really focusing so much on the pain relief right now, because the pain relief, barring the comment from Balachim Omnayich, the pain relief isn't going to rise to the level of life and death. That's not going to justify me overriding the basic rules of Shabbat. Maybe on a lower level I could, but certainly not on a biblical level. So I'm looking at steps that are involved in terms of the fact that you have a patient with an infection, and infections are dangerous. That's really what I'm looking at. So I didn't actually get to the core question yet. All I was doing was just laying out the treatment options and then I sidetracked myself. But we have two choices here. One is call it incise and drain, and the other is pull the tooth. And the way that he framed the question to me at the time, Dr. Wolfson, was the either approach could be used on a weekday, if this were Tuesday, but patients prefer the first approach to drill into the gum, the incising option, in order to keep their natural teeth. Patients would prefer that you not pull their teeth as a general principle. However, it seems that if I take the approach of drilling into the gum, of incise and drain, I am potentially violating more laws of Shabbat than if I would just pull the tooth. So the question is, does the surgeon have the option where there are two possible approaches, one of which involves more violations of Shabbat, one of which involves fewer violations, but the patient prefers the one that takes the more violations, is the surgeon allowed to use the option that patients prefer? So I emailed the question to Rav Shai Schachter to ask his father, Rav Herschel Schachter, and he answered that in this case, it's not a biblical violation for you to drill into the gum. And because of that, and because the patient is fundamentally in a dangerous situation, we view the infection as being dangerous, we do whatever his needs are, you're justified in doing the incise and drain option. And you don't need to go with the tooth pulling option. Okay. There's someone named Rena on here, but I don't know who it is. But I think you had a question?
Sorry.
Yeah.
I did unmute myself for a second by mistake. I happen to be a dentist. I'm Bernie Greenwald's daughter.
Oh, okay.
I will comment that I think that really the only time in my that I would think that I couldn't prescribe antibiotics and painkillers to take care of a patient, even if it's an infection, assuming it's Shabbos and it's not a three-day antib, then it really is a case such as Ludwig's angina where the patient should be hospitalized and treated there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, I don't think that there's an infection that would be so bad that I have to treat this right now by doing a pulpotomy.
Right. So this is really a question of dentistry now. Meaning, I can't answer the question of whether there is such a thing as an infection which must be treated right now or must be treated in the next 6 hours. Keeping in mind, your case can be Friday night and it could be 25 hours. That's a question that really requires the doctor, right? Like we always say, when you're dealing with medical halacha, you need the doctor to establish the facts of the case before the rabbi is able to weigh in. So if you tell me that infections can always wait, other than this Ludwig's angina, which I must admit I'm not familiar with, I know what angina is, but barring that, yeah, if you tell me that it doesn't need, then I'll say, okay, so we're out of the category of life and death.
Probably children. Children, if infection rates are very good. Okay, children, I would say, would be different, yes.
Okay.
Ludwig's angina, and verticillitis are very serious things, and they are basically a matter of life and death. It's relatively rare now because of antibiotics, but those two conditions in particular are very morbid.
Okay. So the okay, that I think addresses somewhat the question then. I'm going to move to the next category because we've spent, 45 minutes and we have a lot to go. So the next category down, if you're looking at the table after number 24, you can see there, is what's called sakanat aver, danger to an aver. This is different from general illness. It's given its own class. And there are two reasons that I've seen offered for why this isn't the same as just a person who's ill in general. In other words, we're going to identify, like you see on the table, life and death danger and illness that is not life and death danger. when we talk about danger to an aver of the body, and I'll explain the word aver shortly, let's say we're talking about somebody's hand. So forget dentistry for a moment. Someone is in danger of losing their hand. That is in its own category. It's not the category of life and death, and it's not the category of non-life and death. It's its own thing. And the reason why it's in its own category, again, I've seen two explanations. One explanation is because this could lead to danger to the body as a whole. If a person, God forbid, loses their hand, they could lose more than their hand, depending on why it happens, depending on what's wrong. Or the other explanation is because this is a permanent loss, and therefore it's valued as being greater than normal pain that a person goes through, which passes. Because if they lose it, then it's an enduring loss. So what exactly is this loss of an aver? So the word aver is a Hebrew word that does not really have a translation in English. There is no valid translation in English for it. The Mishnah teaches that there are 248 different body parts that are called avarim. However, these are so varied. They include the bones of the finger on the one hand. They include soft tissue organs on the other. So there's no one word in English that really renders the word aver fully. So one view is that when we talk about somebody who is in danger of losing an aver, what we mean is any of the 248 body parts that are listed in the Mishnah. That's one view. Rav Shmuel Wasner, the Shevet HaLevi, is of that view. The other view, though, and this I think is the more dominant view, is that what we're talking about is a functional unit of the body, whether we're on the list of the 248 or not. That was the position of the Ketzot HaShulchan, the position of the Shemir Shabbos Gehilchasa, and it's brought in the Nishmas Avram. If you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Neuwirth, author of the Shemir Shabbos Gehilchasa, is quoted in the Nishmas Avram of Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham. There is room to say that danger to an aver is not only regarding a human aver from one of the 248 avarim. And again, I'm not translating the word aver because I don't have a translation. For any distinct component of the human body, regarding which there is concern that if it were not treated now, it would cease to function, this is also called danger to an aver. You follow? That's the way that we look at it. This is considered automatically to be danger to, danger to an aver. Okay. Hang on one second. Sorry, just trying to manage two things at the same time here. I'm going to go back to what I said in the beginning, because at this point, hopefully everybody who's going to be here is here. I need to make sure that people who want to get credit or people who want to be added to the email list send me a message just to me on the chat with your name and email address. If your name is showing, then it's okay. You don't need to do that. But if your full name is not showing or if you're not on the email list, then please make sure to send that to me. All right, thank you. Going back, though, to this this business of the danger to an aver, a part of the body that will not function the way that it normally does, that's called danger to an aver. So what is it that we're allowed to do for such a patient? So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, brings multiple views. The Mishneh Berurah explains that the winning view in the Shulchan Aruch is the one I brought you in source number 15. Direct violation of Shabbat, specifically of a rabbinic prohibition of Shabbat, is what is allowed. If an aver is in danger, thank you to those who are sending me the messages. If an aver is in danger, then one would be able to violate a rabbinic prohibition on Shabbat. And what he means when he says directly means without a shinui, I don't have to do it in an unusual way. That's the principle. So here's the question now. Does losing a tooth qualify as danger to an Avair? And the answer is, it's a debate. If I look at that list of 248 Avarim, which is found in the Mishnah, so teeth are not on the list. They're not part of the list. I brought you source number 16, which indicates that teeth are not part of the list. However, take a look at number 17. Rabbi Dr. Tendler and Dr. Rosner, in an article called Dental Emergencies on the Sabbath, make the following argument. Since the jaw is an aver, and the absence of teeth interferes with its proper functioning, and since the reimplantation of those teeth would restore the proper functioning of the jaw, the traumatic avulsion of teeth represents a situation of chesron aver, of having lost an aver. Since if you lose a tooth, your jaw doesn't function right, and the jaw is an aver, therefore this is considered to be danger to an aver. So that's one argument to say that loss of a tooth is on that level of danger to an aver. There's another argument that you can make as well, which is, if I take the view that any body part that isn't going to function well is automatically danger to an aver, that gives me a different way to look at it. The Nitziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, I brought it for you in source number 18, but I'm going to say it outside, said, you know what? You can chew without one of your teeth. You lose a tooth, you can still chew. I mean, some teeth are more necessary than others for the chewing process. But he says you can chew without it. Therefore, it's not called danger to an aver. I asked the question of Rav Herschel Schechter, and his answer was that substitute teeth, false teeth, are a decent option. He was not willing to call it danger to an aver either. However, there are others who disagree. Rabbi Rafal Evris of Amsterdam, in source number 19, disagreed. He says you can't chew as well with a substitute tooth, and therefore he calls it danger to an aver. So this is something that's subject to debate. You have different points of view regarding this. Clear so far? Okay. Highest level, danger to life. Next level is danger to an aver, which may include the tooth. It's subject to debate. Then below that, you have chole she'ein bo sakana. Somebody whose life is not in danger, but they're very ill. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, defines it as somebody who is bedridden from the illness. A phrase that you will often find is chole kol gufo, one's entire body is ill. Example brought in Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in source number 20. Whoops. I just muted myself by accident. Don't worry. We're all good. In source number 20, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein makes the statement that a fever, which renders people homebound, is sufficient for somebody to be called ill on this level. The Nishmas Avram quotes Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach to say somebody who has a migraine would qualify for this category, even if they're able to walk. But realistically, they're going to have to go to bed. That counts as somebody who is in this category of cholesha shembo sakana, somebody who is ill, just that their life is not in danger. Children automatically qualify for this category of chole she'ein bo sakana. Somebody who is ill, if not is not dangerously so. So I brought that for you from Rav Moshe Isserles in source number 21. Now there's some debate as to who qualifies as a child for this purpose. Some argue, and I brought you a table in source number 22 of sources for the different views, some argue that as long as they eat special baby food, that's what defines them as a child for this purpose. Others disagree and say, no, it's 2 to 3 years old. Others disagree and say, no, it's up to age 6. Based on the idea that until then, they really need a parent around in order to help them. And then finally, you have the view that says up until the age of 9. And that's based on the Talmud's discussion about not fasting at all on Yom Kippur until the age of 9 or 10. So you have a range of views as to who exactly is a child. What are you allowed to do for people in this category? For children under whichever age we adopt here? For somebody who is cholesha ein bo sakana, ill but not dangerously so? So you're allowed to violate a rabbinic prohibition if you do it in an unusual way. Unusual way meaning a way which is not the way you would choose to do it and which is not as effective as the normal way to do it. That's a brief way to explain shinoi. The truth is there's more to be said, but that's what I'm going to go with right now. What if you can't do it in an unusual way? You might as well not treat the patient. So then what do you do? So if so, the Mishnah Berurah writes in source number 23, quoting the Chaye Adam, that if you can't do it in an unusual way, in an altered way, so you do it the normal way. That's what you would do if you have to. Alternatively, a non-Jew could violate a biblical law of Shabbat for you, even though rabbinically I'm not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do things for me on Shabbat that I'm not allowed to do. Nonetheless, I could have a non-Jew do this for me because I'm allowed to violate rabbinic prohibition, so I'm also allowed to ask the non-Jew to do this for me on Shabbat. That's our third category. At this point, you can already see the table. We're on the right side of the page to see it. And hopefully the table is helping people to follow this. The lowest category is what's called mechush. Someone's in a little bit of pain. We've already said that we don't use medicine on Shabbat for someone in this position. This means somebody whose whole body is not ill, they're not bedridden, they have a light headache, that kind of thing. They have a cough, not dealing with a COVID cough, but just a general cough. So we, generally speaking, don't do a whole lot for them. The most we would do is that we could ask a non-Jew to perform something on Shabbat that is rabbinically prohibited. That is something that we would be okay doing. But that's basically it. Now, all of this is Shabbos. What about Yom Tov? What about Chol HaMoed? So if you're dealing with the first day of Yom Tov, which is the day of Yom Tov in Israel, outside of Israel, the first day of Yom Tov, it has the same status as Shabbat for the rules that we've been discussing. There are those who suggest that the decree about not taking medicine shouldn't apply on Yom Tov, for reasons beyond the scope of this discussion. In number 25, I gave you a link to a session I taught about that in 2013. You can see the discussion there. If it's Yom Tov Sheni, the second day of Yom Tov outside of Israel, that's rabbinic. And so we may be more lenient about some of this, and all of this will be permitted on Chol HaMoed. Okay, all of this, everything we've done the last hour, sets us up to answer our vignettes. So now let's take it and talk through the vignettes. Let me pause for a second. Questions, clarifications on what we've done so far? We're good? Doctor? Yeah.
How would the CPU, he says, one is not considered a neighbor, it doesn't affect function. What happens to somebody who's already got a limited number of teeth and he loses two or three more?
Right. So I think he would have to change his position. I think his position only makes sense for where he stated it, which is to say, where you truly do have that function. For that matter, if someone would make an argument that losing certain teeth really does change the function over others, then I think his position doesn't apply as well. I think it's only as good as his logic. Okay, so let's go back to our introductory cases. We have the 7-year-old who presents with a toothache. Right? Avram, age 7, is brought to Dr. Schwartz in Shul Shabbos morning complaining of a toothache. Naked eye observation and probing indicate a significant dental caries. What may Dr. Schwartz do on behalf of Avram? So we look at our first variable. And again, our first variable is level of need. Well, it seems like he has a toothache due to a cavity. Right? He's not in the category of chole kol gufo, his whole body being ill. If Avraham were not 7, but instead 17, we would say it's mechush. You have some pain. Deal with it. However, a child is automatically upgraded to chol she'ein bo sakana, to somebody who is ill, even if their life is not in danger. Assuming that the age of 7 is still within child, and we saw the different possibilities for what constitutes a child, this would mean that I could violate a rabbinic prohibition in an unusual way, and if need be, even in the normal way. So what does this look like for this young child? Well, an oral analgesic would seem to be fine, right? That would seem to be the way to deal with it. Topical analgesics may be harder because of the cotton swab, and that's a bigger challenge. But for the young child, the answer would seem to be, so give him some kind of painkiller. Yeah, let him take the painkiller and move on. But let's make the question harder. Let's say we're now dealing with an adult, not a child, and it's an infected tooth with intolerable pain. Now what do you do? So the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, in source number 26, the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the other side, says, based on all that has been said in addressing this question, it appears that infection inside a tooth causing, quote, powerful, intolerable pain is considered an internal wound. If so, then if there is no non-Jewish doctor, or one doesn't trust him, and the only way is with a Jewish doctor, violating biblical law to heal and numb or remove the tooth, it will be correct to permit it. He says, if it's an infected tooth, he looks at it as maka shel halal, as an internal wound warranting immediate treatment. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, in source number 27, if one suffers from especially strong pain, such that there is concern for infection or pus, or the gums are inflamed even without pain, then they must violate Shabbat as needed, even biblical law, for this could be dangerous. Now, again, dentists come back to me and say, we know this isn't dangerous. Then my answer is, it's like the internal wound where the doctor says, don't worry about it, it doesn't need to be treated today. It doesn't need to be taken care of. However, if you're not sure, then you go back to the rule that's being stated here. Is that clear? Am I going a little too quickly at this point, or are we all right? I need people to respond out loud, because otherwise I won't know. People are okay?
Yeah. All right. I think the question also is that our experience is you probably could wait, but there is a halachic definition of what is cholesterol sakana, which is an internal infection. So does that mean we look at it from a halachic viewpoint, or do we look at it? Our experience is this is not really going to, a few hours is not going to make a difference, even if they may or may not, or they'll use the antibiotic. Where do we...
Right. So I go back to what I had said before about this issue of maka shel chalal, the internal wound, where we said that if it's known to not be dangerous, then it does not qualify as chol she'yesh bo sakana. They're not considered to be dangerously ill. So that's the... Sorry?
Yeah, quick question. So,
yeah.
As a human being, can I go up to my first thing that's to ensure and say, it's okay, it'll be all right. I'm not in pain, it doesn't hurt me at all.
In other words, they're coming to you and they're saying, this hurts a lot, this is infected, take care of me, and you have to now, deal with them. That's what you're saying.
Correct.
This is a question of bedside manner, right? Meaning, I think there are a lot of different ways to speak to patients. I think, to my mind... the first step is to explain. The first step is to show you take it seriously. In other words, this isn't just a go away, I'm in the middle of davening type of a thing. But you leave shul, you look it over, you explain to the patient what you see going on, explain what the standard course of treatment is, and try to highlight for them, assuming you believe that this is something that really can wait. So you say, if this were Wednesday and you were at work and, you called me with this problem, I would tell you, you can finish the day at work and then we'll take care of it afterwards and I'll just give you an analgesic and you'll be all right. I think that's your first step, is to show you take it seriously, explain the medicine of it, try to inspire confidence in the patient, and hopefully the patient listens to you and says, oh, okay, I'm going to go take the painkiller now. if the patient is still pushing after that, then I think you have to ask yourself, in general, how do I deal with a patient who's manifesting this? How do I deal with a patient who is not listening to my medical advice? You know, what are my options? You know, in general, having nothing to do with Shabbos, having nothing to do with halacha. Correct. Right. So this is a very good question. In terms of writing prescriptions on Shabbat, I actually gave a three-part session on this years ago about how one could take care of this. There are certain options that are better. If a computer is already on, emailing may actually be better than writing. It depends a lot on how this is going to be done and in what way. What your options are for writing. The ideal would be to get someone who isn't Jewish to take care of it, obviously. That would be the simplest way to approach it. But it's a little bit beyond the scope of what I can do tonight. Unfortunately, I don't think I'm going to be able to get through that here. Maybe what I'll do is when I send out the follow-up email, I'll include a link to the classes on writing prescriptions on Shabbat, because it is a good question. It's just too big for what we're doing now. Okay. One other note, just within this discussion, injections of anesthesia in the mouth, if you chose to go that route, would seem to be a violation of rabbinic law, not biblical law. And the reason is because there's no intentional aspiration of blood like you would have in an intravenous injection, and the bleeding is not guaranteed. So you'd be able to to do that. Okay, I mean it's a rabbinic prohibition, but rabbinic rather than biblical. Okay, 7-year-old with a loose baby tooth and refusing to eat. So now what do we do? Well, the usual treatment for this tooth, which, again, if you go back to the case, is extremely loose, bleeding likely to be minimal. So the usual treatment would be pull the tooth. So what's the halachic status of pulling a tooth on Shabbos? So this gets really interesting, because the Mishnah Berurah, Rabbi Kagan, who we've been discussing his views all along, quotes an earlier source saying that pulling a tooth is not actually a known cure. Meaning, we have a basic principle in Jewish law that the treatments you're allowed to use on Shabbos have to be what's called refuah biduka, have to be a tested treatment. So in the event that you don't consider something to be a known tested treatment, you can't use it. Mishnah Berurah says, yeah, pulling a tooth is not a known treatment. So that's very odd, because tooth extraction is a really old thing. Like, it's not like this is some newfangled way of dealing with things. So the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, and others quoted by Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham say that where this is the standard of care, don't worry about whether the Mishnah Berurah knew about pulling teeth. We know about pulling teeth, and it's the normal way to treat the problem. So what exactly is the status of pulling teeth on Shabbos? So some argue that it's a biblical prohibition. You're violating biblical law if you pull a tooth on Shabbos. Where does that idea come from? What rule of Shabbat might you be violating by pulling a tooth? What would you say? What biblical law of Shabbat would you be violating by pulling a tooth? Sorry? Causing bleeding? And I heard someone say chovel, right? Which is? Sorry?
Mefarek dash.
Mefarek or dash, why?
Removing something from its source of growth.
Ah, tolish. Okay. So that would be tolish. Mefarek and dash are a little different. But let's go in order. First of all, causing bleeding is chovel. It's an act of wounding. So that's one concern. The Magen Avraham brings that concern in source number 28, and he says, don't tell me it's a destructive act, and therefore it's not a biblical violation, because it's actually constructive wounding. So therefore it violates biblical law. That's one approach. Another approach is, as Chaim suggested, that it's considered to be uprooting something that was growing. Kotzer, Tolesh, that's source number 29 on your sheet from the Aruch HaShulchan. And then there's a third argument, which is very interesting, which gets rejected. But that suggests that it's Gozeis. What is Gozeis? What does Gozeis mean? Right, yeah? Shearing, right? It's like shearing. It's like cutting hair. They, if teeth are not considered to be a permanent part of the body, then they're like hair. However, that's not usually followed. Really, the first two are the major considerations. Is it wounding, or is it uprooting something from the place where it's growing? However, others disagree and say it's neither of those. Number one, it's not called wounding. Why? Because bleeding is not part of the act of removing the tooth. You are doing something which may lead to bleeding, but you're not doing this. You're not creating a wound. You're pulling a tooth, and it may be that that will lead to some bleeding. It's something, though, that you don't want the bleeding. The bleeding is not helpful to you. And therefore, the Mishnah Berurah writing in his Bir Halacha in source number 31 is not willing to consider this to be chovel. As far as kotzer, as far as the concern that you are plucking something from where it's growing, Rabbi Yosef makes the argument that uprooting something on Shabbat is only if it grows from the ground. Teeth do not grow from the ground. And therefore it's not an issue of that either, and therefore it's only a rabbinic prohibition. So based on that, based on the idea that it's a rabbinic prohibition, we do have concern that you're going to cause bleeding. So what we'll do is we'll tell a non-Jew to be the one to remove the tooth if this person is in pain. Remember, it's a chole she'en bo sakana. He's ill, but not dangerously so. So that would be the position for this child. That's what we would like to do. Rabbi Dr. Tendler and Dr. Rosner in source number 32 offer another idea, which goes back to something that Dr. Nussbaum suggested earlier, which is maybe we have two people do it together. Two people hold the tooth together and pull together, because we have a general principle that if two people do an act which could have been done by each one individually, then that makes it only rabbinically prohibited and not biblically prohibited. Finally, if it's dangling by thin tissue and pulling it will not even cause bleeding, then halachic authorities permit it as well for somebody who's in pain if you do it by hand. Rabbi Wozner, in source number 33, makes this point. If the person is in pain, if it's not even going to cause bleeding, so just do it by hand and be done with it. So we have ways to help this child. The ideal, get someone who isn't Jewish to be the one to do it, but you could have two people hold it and pull at the same time. Maybe you let the kid hold on and somebody else and pull. Not sure whether the kid is going to be happy about that idea. Or alternatively, if it's really not going to cause bleeding, so then you could do it, you could pull by hand. And that would be potentially okay. Third case. We've got 10 minutes to go. Yes, Laura.
Would it be preferable to have the dentist do this or the parent? Because you need to have it be a dentist that does this.
Well, why would we require a dentist?
That's what I'm asking. Like, if they brought the kid to you and the tooth is hanging by a thread, does it need to be the dentist that does that?
From a halachic perspective, from a halachic perspective, if the parent would be allowed to do it and would be okay doing it during the week, there's no reason why the parent couldn't do it on Shabbos. Yeah, it's not undermining the care. Okay. Well, the third case: 13-year-old boy lost a permanent tooth. So please correct me if I'm wrong, but here's my understanding: is that you can reseat this within half an hour and keep it in place, stable, and it will take. Is that correct? I'm getting...
Probably.
Yeah, probably. Probably. From what I'm told, that's what works, and you can even drink without pushing the tooth out of place, and then, fine, so after Shabbos, you'll do whatever you have to do, the paste, the wires, whatever it is. However, in our case, it's a 13-year-old boy. And let's pretend that this happens at 1 o'clock on a Shabbos in May, so that Shabbos is not ending for another 8.5 hours. Good luck having the 13-year-old boy hold the tooth in place for the next 8.5 hours. So what do you do? Well, in part, we go back to our first variable. What's the level of need? If we view loss of a tooth as sakanas aver, right, damage to an aver, in that case, we're going to say a Jew is allowed to violate rabbinic prohibitions in order to take care of this situation. So what exactly is the act of malacha? What is being done when you reseat a tooth and put something there to keep it in place? If it's biblical, like if it's construction, bona, right, then I'm out of luck because this person's not in a life and death case. But if it's rabbinic, then I'll say, well, if you believe that losing a tooth is sakanas aver, like Rabbi Tendler argued, it's danger to an aver, then I'll be allowed to seat the tooth. The rule is that, in fact, the prohibition against bonet, against construction on Shabbos, does apply to the human body. I brought you a source. Did I bring it on here? No, I didn't bring it on here. But the Gemara talks about, indeed, that the term bonet could apply to things like braiding hair, that's called construction, or adjusting someone's vertebrae, interestingly. However, if the way you're keeping the tooth in place is only a temporary fix, it's not something that's going to hold it long term, then it's down to being rabbinic. It's temporary bone. And indeed, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, in source number 34, writes the following. Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank already permitted this in a responsum regarding false teeth which shift from their place and fall out, saying one may make them stick with powder atop the teeth, which will cause them to adhere to the palate, since this will only last for several hours. I have similarly permitted it. So the argument is do some kind of temporary fix. Now creating the paste is in and of itself a problem potentially, and it may be a biblical issue that's called lush. You have to be careful about how you prepare the paste, but that's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about right now. But in practice, what we'll say is he can hold it in place. And if you have a temporary adhesive material ready for it, it would seem to have a basis for leniency. Okay. Our last case. We're going to see if we can do this in 5 minutes. The bride with her new husband loses an aesthetic porcelain crown on the first night of a 3-day Yom Tov. So, as I understand it, the way to deal with a crown, and when I say loses the crown, let's say it's a misplaced crown. Right? Going back to the clarification we had in the beginning. The way you would deal with this normally is that you do use a painkiller for the tooth sensitivity, and then there are temporary pastes that can hold the crown until you can have it completely repaired. Is that correct?
Probably wouldn't have any sensitivity, temporary, you can cement a temporary, yes.
Mm-hmm. Other dentists?
Nope.
Agreed. Okay. So, what's the level of need here? The level of need here did not appear on our list before. It's a separate category. It's called kavod habriot, human dignity. You could just say to her, look, you know, a displaced crown is not on the COVID-19 list of dental emergencies. But we have precedents in Jewish law for concern when you're dealing specifically with a kala, when you're dealing with a new bride. That comes up in other areas of Jewish law as well. And we have a principle that human dignity overrides rabbinic prohibitions. So I gave you some examples on the sheet, but I'm skipping the examples in the interests of time. So in that case, what am I able to do for this displaced crown? We said that temporary pastes may only be a violation of rabbinic law. But at what point does a temporary paste become permanent? So it's really unclear, especially if you're dealing with a three-day Yom Tov. Meaning, I brought you on the sheet in source number 38, source number 39, that using some kind of a paste on Shabbos, where you plan to remove it right after Shabbos, would be considered temporary. However, here you have 3 days to go. So I'm not sure that qualifies as temporary. I'm not certain. It's a question which I would like to send away to a great halachic authority to answer, but all the great halachic authorities right now are busy answering COVID questions, and I hesitate to ask them an academic one. So I think it's going to wait a little while until, you know, non-pandemic times before I'm able to get an answer on this. I think it's a very interesting question. Could you perhaps reseat the crown using a temporary paste? There's also a side issue, which is the patient positioning their jaw in such a way to help the work being done. Is that an issue of misayaya? Is that an assisting issue? But that's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about right now. So just a verbal summary of the steps for our cases. The child with a toothache, analgesic. The adult with a toothache. So if it's just light pain, then don't really do anything. What the adult could do is what they did when I was a kid, which is, you know, let him swish some brandy around and let that numb the spot. Since drinking is not, you know, it's a normal activity in terms of drinking, it doesn't look like application of medicine. The fact that there's a side benefit in numbing the tooth is okay. If the patient is confined to bed, then treat it as a makah shel chalal, as an internal wound, unless you know that it's really not that level of dangerous. Pulling a tooth. So if a patient is in great pain, you could have a non-Jew pull the tooth, and if there's no bleeding, and they're in pain, then you could even do it to pull it by hand for the child, as we talked about. The lost permanent tooth, reseat it. Ideally without any sort of fixative, but you could potentially use the temporary one if this is considered to be a sakanas aver. And then the displaced crown, we have the possibility maybe of a temporary paste, but I want to look into that further in terms of the length of time that it's going to have to be in place. I'm going to take questions. I just want to make sure to note one more time, if anybody on this Zoom wants credit and is not already on my email list, or their full name isn't showing, please make sure to write your name into the chat, just a message to me. Or email me, and that way I'll know to add you. Okay, thank you very much. We actually got it done in 90 minutes, one way or the other. But I'm going to take questions now, so anyone has to go, you can go. Those who have questions, stay on, please.
Sort of a touchy here.
Yeah.